Bold. Brave. Herb with Dr. Pam Peek.
Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and this is episode 546 of the Bold and the Brave Her podcast. Today, I'm joined by someone I have revered forever. We share a common background academically, and you'll hear about that. But I have been doing the happy dance ever since she and her team said, yes, why, of course, let's share about this extraordinary new book. All right. We're so delighted to be joined by Dr. Marion Nessel. She is literally a nutrition science legend. And I say that to embarrass the crap out of her, but she is. And most people know her name because of her 95 books that she's written, some of which most of us have ordered, held on to over generations. I mean, seriously. My gosh, what she has done to the nutrition industry is extraordinary, because I'm going to tell you something. She has attitude. She has some serious attitude. And the attitude is extraordinary, because when she faces the food industry, they usually have their first nightmare of the day. And that is that, oh God, she's going to talk about the food industry. So she wrote a book called What to Eat. And that book, I think the grand majority of people still have a copy of, and I refer to all the time. And then for reasons she's going to divulge, she is going to share why she wrote the new book, What to Eat Now. Dr. Nessel is the Paulette Goddard Professor of Medicine, Food Studies, and Public Health Emerita at New York University, in the department she chaired from 1988 to 2003, and from which she retired in September of 2017. She's also visiting professor of nutrition sciences at Cornell. She holds honorary degrees from just about everybody. She is extremely highly cited in the scientific literature. Marion, welcome to the Her podcast.
No, glad to be here. Thank you for the embarrassing introduction.
I know. I'm here to embarrass. No, look, folks out there in the Her podcast land, today I am a fangirl. Okay, so I'm just going to act like one, because Marion has always been such an extraordinary legend. I have read her studies, her books for years. I've referred to them for years. And now I have the absolute pleasure of this amazing interview to talk about this new book, where she kicked some serious nutrition science ass and did what she always does, which is, you know, come at it with attitude, which I absolutely love. She does not hold back. She talks about this wild and crazy world of nutrition science. Now, get your fingers off that TikTok right now. Come on now. That's not where you learn nutrition. I saw you out there in the Her podcast land. All right, Marion, seriously, you have been at this for decades, and we're all happy about that. And you are still kicking it, which we love. You're crushing it, actually. And so we all want your brain. We all want your energy after, you know, doing this for so long. Now, you wrote this book, What to Eat Now. You added that one word. Why did you write this book?
Well, it was a pandemic project. I was holed up in Ithaca during the pandemic, where upstate New York, where my partner lives, and it's pretty quiet up there. And I thought, I need a project. And so I looked at What to Eat and thought, gee, this really reads well. Timeless classic, except it's out of date.
Damn it, I hate it when that happens.
You know, it feels a little dated. And maybe the publisher would be interested in updating it. And eventually the publisher was. And I promised the publisher I could knock off an update in 6 months. And here we are 4 years later.
What's with the 4 years?
Well, I have never underestimated the amount of work involved in doing anything. I mean, I just had no idea. They said you have to use at least 40% of the original text, or you have to a supply, at least 40% new text. I think I supplied 90% new text, certainly 80%. Basically, the book had to be completely rewritten. There was not a single product that I used as an example in 2006 that still existed.
You can't buy
a single one of those products at supermarkets now. They've gone. They've disappeared. And I still mourn Häagen-Dazs frozen yogurt. I know that stuff.
Damn.
Which I used as the example to discuss food labels. Doesn't exist. So that was one sort of obvious change. But I hadn't really been paying very close attention. And I was just shocked by the changes. The most obvious was that the walls of Coke and Pepsi that would line the store when you walked in weren't there anymore. They'd been replaced by bottled waters, flavored, usually fruit-flavored waters of one kind or another, house brand ones. I mean, one of the big changes is the influx of house brands. And every major supermarket chain has its own house brand. Kroger has it, Walmart has it, Target has it, Wegmans has it, they all have it. So that was a big change. And then could hardly find organic foods 20 years ago, now they're everywhere. Could hardly find international foods, now they're everywhere. Plant-based meats are new. Ultra-processed foods are new, new term. Since the book came out, very important concept. And I think one of the biggest changes is people are buying groceries online. The pandemic did that big time, but it took off and it's not going back to pre-pandemic levels. And almost a third of grocery sales are online now, which has changed the organization of supermarkets and also changed what people are buying. So all of that's new. And as I went through each aisle of the supermarket, it wasn't just a matter of updating and changing the references and updating what's the new rules and the new laws and the new regulations and the new concerns. It was really doing much more than that. I don't know. I got to write that book twice. I mean, and I should say it's a very big book. Oh, my goodness.
Let's see how big it is. Come on now.
Oh, my
goodness. Okay, no, no, but do it on the side so I can see how fat it is. Oh, my God. This thing is huge. Do you use that like as a doorstop or, you know?
I don't know. I mean, it's just, it's 700 pages. It's amazing. People are telling me that it's very easy to read, so that's nice.
You've always known how to write well. You know, you don't over-science-y it. You basically keep it fairly practical. Well, I loved it.
I mean, I wrote this not to tell people what to eat, because I would never do that. But I wrote, I want people to...
Oh, come on!
I mean, really, I don't tell people what to eat. Yeah, I don't. You know, I'll tell them what I eat, but that's as far as it'll go. I want people to think about food issues and advocate for a better food system. And that's really what this book is about, is how to think about food issues. Here are the issues. Here are the trade-offs. Here are the things you need to think about if you want to think about them. And if you don't, just go to the store and buy what you want and don't give it a thought.
So what are the, you know, I was looking at the book. You know, you've got the basics, which I love, diet and health, duh, you know, decoding the food labels. I mean, the food labels have gone through a few little changes in the last generation, right? Yeah, and the health claims, endorsements, and then the whole issue of diets and dieting. Give us just a very brief little touch base on diets and dieting.
Well, all diets work if you stick to them. They all work.
Okay, let's move on.
Every single one of them will work if you follow it. You know, the big ones now are high protein diets. That's the current fad. That'll change eventually. Right now, everybody's pushing protein, which as a nutritionist, I find hilarious because most people eat twice the protein they need already, and you certainly don't need any more.
And you just pee it out anyway.
No, you know, you use the amino acids for building blocks. And if you've got too much.
No, but excessive.
Yeah, you're if burning you have off excessive. As energy and storing yeah. it as fat and doing all those other things. But protein is unlikely to be harmful or seriously harmful in large quantities. But it makes no sense to me to, you know, eat protein supplements or proteins in everything. It's in potato chips. It's in soft drinks. It's in beer. Really?
Wait a minute. It's in my chair.
It's being added to everything these days.
I know. I think part of it is some of my fellow board members with the American College of Sports Medicine are some of the top names, you know, Stu Phillips up at McMaster and his work with protein. What we now have is an interesting enhancement of our knowledge base based upon both gender and age specific. After you turned, you know, 60 or 70, you sort of fell off a cliff. And so much of the research is like, I don't know, just figure it out there. If you end up being a 100-year-old, God bless you. You know, it's like, well, wait a minute. And then we were thinking for a long time in medicine, you know, don't over-protein older people, only to find out older people actually need, you know, a hell of a lot more protein than they've been getting because their nutrition.
They're not eating much.
They're not eating. That's the whole point. Right. They're eating so little, and what they eat is like, you know, really? Seriously? You just ate a couple cornflakes and, you know, like, yeah, I got it. No, you don't. No, it's called protein. You need it. And of course, when you're facing frailty, when you're facing the sarcopenia, you know, when you drop age-related muscle during your 60s, you need to be able to be on top of all of that and be proactive. And I think that that's a very good thing. We're looking at protein and health in that regard. And I'm also extremely happy to see that there's some gender-specific research coming out. Oh my goodness, women and men. You know, when I was at the NIH, Bernadine Healy showed up. She was the first woman and the only woman to ever run the joint. First thing out of her mouth was, not a penny to anyone unless you include women in your research if it's appropriate, right? And I was like, you go, girl. And of course,
what
she was.
What a concept.
I know. And then, you know, they started calling her the B word, ends with an H. And I said, bring it on, man. And she was fearless. She just said, no, looking at every single grant. You know, where are women? Come on now. And stop extrapolating. So that was an exciting thing. But that also happened in nutrition, right? So that's a very good thing. So now that's diets and dieting. It's pretty crazy out there. Now, right off the bat, I saw a fantastic interview with you where you had major attitude. This was wonderful. Here it comes. All right. That interview was when they were talking about breakfast, the three squares a day, but you know, people having breakfast and you did the cavewoman thing. And I've been doing it forever. I fell off my chair. I said, Marion and I are aligned. Can you please give us the breakfast talk?
Oh, I'm not a breakfast eater.
No, that's what I mean.
I think you should eat when you're hungry. I don't get hungry till about 11. I don't know what meal of the day that is. But that's when I feel like eating, and I don't really want to eat anything before then. And I certainly don't want to eat anything when I first wake up. I know this is completely contrary to nutrition advice that breakfast is the most important meal of the day. But that advice was designed by breakfast cereal companies. They sponsored all the research on the importance of breakfast.
There's no bias there.
No,
come on
absolutely
now.
Absolutely not. And particularly the cereal companies wanted breakfast equated with cereal. So they did a lot of research to show how healthy everybody was if they had cereal first thing in the morning. That's fine. If you want to eat breakfast, that's fine. I just don't.
Isn't that interesting? You know, what we're taught basically, you know, just looking at, you know, the new concepts around metabolism and the metabolome and all the rest. What they usually say is they say, well, insulin secretion is most efficient early, like in the morning. That could be 11 o'clock, but in the morning. And that by the time you hit around after 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, it becomes less efficient, meaning that you're really not metabolizing optimally, meaning that, you know, there's a greater chance that if you do take in your carbs and all the other little goodies later in the day, and certainly when you're having Mount Saint pasta for dinner, and it's usually a late dinner, that your insulin's like, meh, you know, what do we do with this stuff? And so you're more likely to pile on the calories and the fat. So this is one of the reasons why it works that way. But I think a lot of, you know, when I saw you say that, you also brought up, you know, the caveman thing. So go through that.
Oh, you mean the paleo diet?
Well, no. Actually, the fact that this is what I always say, and you said the same thing. What you said was, okay, let's go back to, you know, caveman, cavewoman. They get up in the morning with the Tweety birds because, you know, you don't want to hang around the cave for too long. Got to get out there. And guess what? You got to eat. So it's time to forage and hang out, right?
Hunt and gather.
Hunt and gather, forage and gather. Just do it. And so what ended up happening was, you know, they were lucky to score a meal every day, right? I mean, like a real meal.
Well, they survived. They must have had something that kept them going.
Well, no, but you know what's really cool, Marion, is that the way I look at it is this goes to Sachin Panda's work at the Salk Institute and Walter Longo at USC. And this is where you're looking at circadian rhythm. I'm a real circadian rhythm person. Honor the clock is what I like to say. So if you really look at the secretion of hormones, right, throughout the 24-hour cycle, everything from melatonin at nighttime, you know, to insulin and corticosteroids, you know, cortisol in the morning, what you actually find is that they all follow a circadian rhythm. There's a reason why there was a very lovely Nobel Prize handed out in 2021 on this whole thing when they kind of figured this out. So circadian rhythm is very important. At the end of the day, your entire metabolism was built around this. When can you most efficiently chew up those calories and utilize them for fuel when you're rocking and rolling? So I loved what you said. You said, well, think of a cavewoman. What does she do? Like, you know, get up and go, hey, let's start with breakfast. What? You got to score some food.
Right. Hunt and gather and get your step counts in at the same time. Now, what I think is really interesting is what the new GLP-1 drugs are doing about our knowledge about how all of this works. We're learning so much from them. They're so fascinating. I mean, I'm completely riveted by them because they make people not as hungry, but not as hungry selectively. You know, they're not as hungry for junk food. And, ooh, isn't that interesting? So they want healthier foods and they're looking for healthier eating. And, well, it's going to be interesting to see how all that works out.
Well, you know, I'm watching the evolution of the GLPs. A lot of my colleagues are actually involved with the trials. And what's interesting is that they started with one receptor agonist, and now they're up to four now.
Rolling them all in.
Yeah, just roll them in, you know, GLP, GIP, everybody, let's just do it. And then they had a little whoopsie moment when they went, uh-oh, we're losing a lot of lean mass. What's going on here? And it's like, yeah, you are, for a lot of reasons. You know, it's both direct effect on the muscle itself, as well as the fact that, you know, a funny thing happens. People just don't eat that much. So next thing you know, they're not eating protein. What's also, you said selective. People find there's a subsector of people who do not find protein to be tasty anymore. Who knew? And so they're eating less protein, and there go the muscles. And that's a very bad thing, last time I looked. And so,
I'm not sure the protein powders make up for it either.
Yeah, well, that's actually an incredibly good point. I'm a firm believer in trying to get everything through whole food, and there are plenty of tasty ways to get protein out there, whether it's vegetarian or, you know, however you want to play the game, you can do it and make it really, really tasty. But that means you have to, oh no, the four-letter word, cook. And so how many people are actually doing that? Come on now. Well, you and I were weaned on. Okay, so what you all of you in the Her podcast land have to know is that Dr. Nessel and I both are graduates of UC Berkeley. That should explain everything, but I digress. So Dr. Nessel stayed for her PhD in nutrition science.
Molecular biology.
Oh, molecular biology. That's right. It was molecular biology.
I was a bench scientist.
That's right. You were bench all the way. That's right. So I did undergrad and then I did grad. I did a master's in public health, public policy before I went on to med school. So you went the PhD route. I went the MD route, but we both shared wild and crazy times because I went to the Berkeley co-op all the time and I lived there and I cooked. I made my own bread. I did everything. I mean, the produce at the co-op was to die for. And I mean, I don't know. I'm trying to remember, but I think it was organic, right? It was the Berkeley co-op.
But they had a really great selection. And there are still a couple of places in Berkeley that still have the best produce I've ever seen. People in California are so lucky. They have no idea.
I know. And it's just, oh my gosh. I lived on Northside up near the Rose Garden. A lot of my professors lived up in that area too. So we hung. And it was a good time. Linus Pauling showed up, taught biochemistry. Okay. I was there for that. He lived up on Northside as well with his little paper bag and his lunch in those, you know, little brown bag thing. It was kind of cool. So, you know, just talking to you brings me right down memory lane because we had a different appreciation of food then. For me, whole food was whole food. I mean, you ate produce and you cooked.
Well, there wasn't as much processed food then.
There really
wasn't, or what we're now calling ultra-processed.
Okay, now you've mentioned that twice, so tag, you're it. You're going to have to explain this because you know that the hellscape out there on trying to explain ultra-processed. What is this?
It's a term that's new since the first edition of the book. And I think it's a very important concept. It was invented by Carlos Montero, who's a professor of public health at the University of São Paulo in Brazil. Okay, Brazil. We're Americans. We don't care what happens in Latin America. But this was a very important concept. And he divided foods into a classification system called NOVA, which is what he named it, that divides foods by their degree of processing. The first three categories are food, and they're unprocessed foods, you know, apples off the tree, corn off the cob, that kind of thing. And then processed culinary ingredients, which are things like salt, sugar, fat, that you add to unprocessed foods in order to make them processed, which includes foods that are frozen and foods that are canned, but minimal processing. And then the fourth category he called ultra processing, which are industrially transformed foods that don't look anything like the foods they came from, require elaborate equipment to turn into these things, usually have a lot of additives, as well as salt, sugar, and fat, are designed to be irresistibly delicious, if not addictive, and are, you can't make them in your home kitchen because you don't have the additives or you don't have the equipment. Once those categories were established, it became possible to do research. And there have now been more than 1,000 studies with the word ultra-processed in the title. And of those, there are more than 100 clinical trials. And of those clinical trials, 90% show that ultra-processed diets in which the majority of calories come from ultra-processed foods, increase the risk of obesity, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, cancer, overall mortality, the whole works. Those are observational studies. They can only show correlation. They can't show causation. But there are now 3 or 4 clinical trials, extremely well controlled, that demonstrate that ultra-processed foods induce people to eat more calories than if they're eating relatively unprocessed diets. but a lot more calories. So in the first study, 500 more calories a day, in the second, 800, and in the third, 1,000 more calories. So for me, that's reason enough to sort of cut back on these things. Nobody in the United States needs extra calories these days.
Yeah. You know, when I wrote my book, my last book was The Hunger Fix. It was the first consumer book on food and addiction. And this is after Ashley Gearhart had done her work at Yale, and she's now at Michigan, and developed the food addiction scale based upon the addiction scale that people typically use for everything from alcohol to drugs and back and forth. And I knew this. I could listen to this on the part of my patients. They were absolutely hooked. There was no question. The other thing I ended up doing was I was asked by one of the largest addiction groups in the country to come and to try to address the issue of addictive eating. Because what would happen is they'd go to some fancy schmancy rehab, spend a lot of time in California, just saying. And they're at a fancy schmancy rehab. And this is what they would do. First, I had to observe, you know, most of this was not shocking, but it was kind of wild. And so they'd be off there. Now, no one's on just one thing anymore. They're on like E, all of the above at whatever time and whatever date. So it's alcohol and pills and injections. And it's a wild west out there. And it just breaks my heart. When I see that, when I see a person coming in who's just, you know, so we get them through the hell of that. Then this is what they do. They start drinking can after can of Monster, Red Bull. So what they're doing is the action is taking place in the nucleus accumbens, which is the reward center of the brain. What they're trying to do is they're trying to get, as it were, a legal high. They want to get as much pleasure and as much dopamine release as they can get that would even come within spitting distance of heroin, meth, fentanyl, God knows what else, you know, alcohol and back and forth. So they would, I mean, seriously, they would pour a cup of coffee and like half a bag of sugar would go into it. And it was unbelievable. It just, whoa, we got to deal with this. And the same thing with food per se. And of course, cigarette smoking is a legal high. So you'd see a lot of smoking and a lot of this crazy, you know, eating thing going on. So what we decided to do, I put together a culinary team of wild and crazy people, right? Chefs and RDs and culinary nutritionists. Okay. So people who really had a hell of a background. And I grabbed them all and I said, we're going to fight it out with the high-level sugar stuff and the caffeine stuff. And we created menus that were 50 times more delicious than the stuff they were trying to get. And then I converted them over to water with beautiful fruit cut up in the water. They'd never tasted this. All they'd ever had was that other crap. If you do this gradually over time, a little miracle took place. And the other thing that really cuts down on addiction is physical activity. Oh, it's huge.
Always a good thing.
Well, the research shows that you get 10 times, seriously, the rehab benefit from physical activity than if they're just sitting around feeling bad about themselves. So get them out there, throw balls, do whatever, run. I don't care what you do. Just, you know, get
move.
Your ass up and
just
moving.
Move.
Yeah, man. You know, they set up volleyball courts and they beat each other up and it was great stuff. So you got to take it seriously. So when people say, oh, I think I'm addicted to it, you are guaranteed. I can guarantee you are because it's like a bingeable thing. Right. So if you can't say, remember the old Lay's potato chip ad? If you can't have just one. If you can't have just one, okay, that sucker in front of you, whatever it is, all right, liquid or solid, that is a bingeable.
Well,
that's the way
whole
I wrote
point.
It up.
You know, I mean, yeah. Food companies are not social service agencies and they're not public health agencies. They want you to eat as much as you possibly can of what they're making because they've got stockholders to please.
Well, there's a lot of that going on. And, you know, you have this one section called the center aisles. I always love the center aisles when you write that, because it's going to be hell to pay. And this is where you went into ultra process. The cereals are just amazing. I have a cereal story, and the cereal story I'm going to tell you when we come back. The Her Podcast is sponsored by Solaray Vitamins, Minerals, and Herbs, all rooted in nature. In addition to women's multivitamins, Solaray, S-O-L-A-R-A-Y, is presenting the new Her Life Stages products, providing support for the menstrual years, including PMS, perimenopause, menopause, and postmenopause, and even libido. This integrative holistic approach has a woman's back throughout her entire life journey. To learn more about Her Life Stages, you've got options. You can run on over to your local health food store or check it out at Whole Foods, Sprouts, Amazon, or scroll over to Solaray.com and use promo code HER20 for 20% off your purchase. Women, Solaray's got your back. And we're back. Okay, it's cereal time. So I just interviewed a kind of an amazing person on my podcast. This was fairly recently. Her name is Natalie Grabow, and she became quite the sensation all over the internet. Why? Well, she's 80. She was the first woman at the age of 80 to ever successfully complete the Ironman Triathlon World Championship in Kona. Now, I'm a triathlete. I'm here to tell you, that sucker is kick ass. And there were 30-year-olds who didn't finish. And here she is. She's kind of trooping through. And she finished. The best part of it, and the reason why it was so popular, is about, I would say 10 feet right before she hit. You know, there's always an archway, which is the finish line. And we wear chips. They're attached to our ankle or someplace. And so we have to get across the archway for the chip to go ding, and they'd give you your time, your actual time. So you got to get under that. So just as she's 10 feet away, she face plants. I mean to tell you, it was gorgeous. Oh, no. So she's running along. No, it was kind of cool. You know, she's swinging with the program here. What happened is the computer carpet had some wrinkles in it, and she stumbled over one of those wrinkles because, let's just say, a whole lot of people had been ahead of her. You know, this was 16 hours and 44 minutes or something, because you had to make it in 17 hours. So she made it. You know, she picked herself up. She had that look about her, kind of reminded me of you. She was just like, who's the moron who, you know, put the wrinkle here? I'm going to slap him. And she had that little look, you know, it was like, oh my God, you know, I fell. Oh no. She was like, come on over here. If you did this to me, I'm going to show you which way is up. So then she went right through the archway, and the whole place fell apart and, you know, whatever. So I said, I got to talk to her. So we did. She and I have become kind of really cool friends now. So the first thing I asked, you know, as we were getting to know each other, I said, girlfriend, what do you have for breakfast? Because you see, since she's she's more of an extreme exerciser, she's going to eat more. They just do. So she's up at about 5 and she's caregiving her husband. There's some stuff going on there. It's all good. She has it all scheduled. So I said, what do you eat? And she goes, Cheerios. And I'm like, let me just get this straight. You're 80. You're one of the, you just went into the Iron Man Hall of Fame. The Guinness Book people just gave you your certificate, and you eat Cheerios? And she goes, I said, how long have you been doing that? And she said, most of my life. She said, but they're healthy because I put blueberries on them. So I'm sitting there, I'm going, Natalie, I love you. I just love you. And I said, do you ever get tired of Cheerios? You know, like you got to back up somewhere. She goes, oh, yeah. And I said, well, what do you eat? She says, frosted mini wheats. So now, you know, we have an N of one experiment, which is her level of physical activity just supervenes over all the other stuff she does. And then I said, well, what's your treat? She says, oh, well, I do that dark chocolate. And I said, yeah, bring it on, girlfriend. And then I said, what else? She goes, marshmallows. I just love marshmallows. And I said, really? She goes, yeah, handfuls. Great stuff. And I just said, I love you more. All right. And then, of course, she has her protein and she has her vegetables and everything else. I just thought it was beautiful that she's not following some, you know, kind of obsessive tech bro, you know, how the guys are going with, you know, you have to eat exactly this. And so the reason why I bring that up is because there's a lot of wiggle room here.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
oh,
there's yeah. so much wiggle room. So talk to me about wiggle room.
Well, first of all, I have to tell you that my next book is about cereals.
You have to talk to Natalie. I'll hook you up.
I've collected cereal boxes for years, especially ones with completely ridiculous health claims on them. And I have a co-author, and we wrote a book about food and nutrition policy using cereal boxes to illustrate. And it's going to come out in September 2026. It's called...
Ooh, you're going to be back.
It's called Sugar Coated. And it's coming out. And, you know, I do almost the same thing, but I eat mini wheats because they have a lot more fiber than Cheerios.
Yep.
So I like having a high fiber breakfast when I get around to eating it. And I always have fruit with it. I think it's
okay,
a great
Marian,
way to start the day.
Everyone out there in the Her Podcast land wants to know what you eat. So we want to hear it. So right around 11 o'clock when you're getting a little hungry, what do you eat? Come on now.
I'm post mini wheats, no sugar, no salt. And I add my own sugar. And even adding my own sugar is going to be a lot less than pre-sweetened cereals. And I have blueberries or some other kind of berries with it. That starts the day. After that, it's a free-for-all. It just depends on what I'm doing and where I am and what's happening.
So are you a flexitarian?
Oh,
what are
absolutely.
You?
Absolutely. I'm an omnivore.
Omnivore.
I eat everything.
If it's in front of you,
yeah.
It's game.
I follow my own advice. I don't find it very hard to follow, you know, easily summarized by Michael Pollan as eat food, not too much, mostly plants, as long as the food is not too ultra-processed. I have my favorite ultra-processed foods. If you ask me my favorite food, it's...
Okay, go for it. I'm waiting.
Ice cream.
I love ice cream.
Yeah,
it's fantastic.
Too.
I just
too.
Like high-quality ice cream.
Oh, yeah.
If I'm going to have it, I don't want trash.
Yeah, I want really good ice cream, and I particularly like ginger. But, you know, I think that the idea that one diet is a prescription for everybody makes no sense. You look at worldwide diets, they're completely different. They vary in every possible way, but the basic principles of good nutrition are always the same. And that's to eat a wide variety of relatively unprocessed foods in reasonable amounts.
I know. And then obviously,
pretty simple.
Match it with physical activity.
Oh,
notice I don't use the E word, exercise.
No, I live in New York. I don't exercise. I just live in New York. And I don't have a car.
Marian, what words of advice do you have for people out there as we do the close now? As they feel hopeless seeking out help from TikTok and Google.
You know, food is one of life's most important pleasures, and it's really important to enjoy your food, and I just wish everybody wouldn't worry so much about it and just eat real food, don't eat a lot of junk food, make sure you eat your vegetables, and don't worry about it. Eat what you like. Have fun with it. Food is wonderful fun.
And act like a cavewoman. That's what I have to say. Ooh, I love it. Everyone
not sure
out
about
there,
that.
I've had the absolute pleasure of having someone I've revered for so long, Dr. Marian Nestle. She is the author of God knows how many books, but the most important one right now is What to Eat Now. What to Eat Now. And then in next year, you're going to get sugar-coated too. There's another one coming down the pike. Marian, I can't begin to thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. It was a pleasure to be here. It's great to see you again.
Awesome. And I want to thank my sponsor, Solaray Vitamins, Minerals, and Herbs Rooted in Nature, and their new Her Life Stages product. Scope it all out at solaray.com and take a moment, leave a review for us now because we'd love to hear from you. This has been a production of Podcast Health. And remember, you're in this world for a limited time, but the things you can do with that time are not. So come on out there. Carpe diem. Seize the day. Thanks for listening, everyone.